Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Heart of Stone by Rebecca Ruger. Narrated by Stuart Crank. Prologue. Nairn, Scotland. Summer, 1299. Until he had first stepped foot outside of Carehaze, Callum MacKinnon had no idea that most chiefs, or men of some worth with keeps to maintain and crofters and landholders and serfs to oversee, normally conducted their daily business inside the hall. Seated behind the same trestle table upon which his evening meal would be served, the master of the keep would hear grievances and receive messages, review accounts, and entertain visitors. Daytime affairs of the keep would see the table bared, the worn wood gleaming under the drumming fingers of an impatient chief. During the supper hour, when his family or guests or men-at-arms shared the table with him, the wood was hidden beneath a fine cloth of linen, mayhap embroidered with the family's crest, or in some cases, whatever animal the family had claimed as its talisman. Callum wouldn't learn until later in life, when the world he knew expanded, that his uncle's practice of managing all the business of Carehaze from a tiny room at the rear of the keep was unusual. The room, of which most persons' first impression was merely orange, was found at the end of a dimly lit and twisting corridor, one floor below and directly beneath the kitchens. And like other things, he'd only been made aware of when he'd reached an age to understand that it was generally a good practice to take note of the details of an environment. Callum had only recently learned that while the small chamber certainly appeared as a dead end, with surely naught but dirt holding up the four stone walls, at one time, an exit had been dug and carved into the earth. It could be accessed behind the lone tapestry in the room, covering nearly half of the southwest wall, behind which there was a thick timbered door, to which only Donal had the key, and from which one might reach fresh air and blue sky beyond the walls of Carehaze. Orange was impressed first and foremost, despite the fact that the sandstone walls were very light. The chamber was windowless and lit by a precarious abundance of tapers, too many for a room so slight, and containing so much parchment and leather, but which cast the stone of the wall and the timber of the ceiling, and even the dirt of the floor, into shades of auburn, or salmon, or ginger, dependent upon perspective and nearness to the flames. The tapestry itself showcased the blue and grey and green of the MacKinnon tartan, but here, in this room, it took on a burnt and golden hue. The door was ever closed, but Callum rapped his knuckles on the dark wood, as he'd been summoned only moments ago by his uncle. The call for entry from within came at the same time Callum was already pushing open the door. He bent his head as he cleared the doorway, but, thankfully, was allowed to assume his full height within. Donal MacKinnon did not look up immediately, but continued to frown over a missive in front of him, even as he waved his hand with some impatience, bringing Callum one step closer to the wide table. So little of the scarred wooden top of the table was visible, covered with pots of ink and sheaths of parchment, and a scattering of small tools and several rings of keys. Folding his hands at his waist, Callum waited. He didn't bother to glance around. Nothing changed inside this room. It was ever and would ever be crammed with crusty leather journals and ink-stained paper and dusty relics. He couldn't sit, as Donal occupied the lone chair in the room, behind the table. He didn't like to be pulled away from the training field, not when he'd so recently received word that Wallace might again be calling up patriots, that he might now have the numbers and means to avenge last year's debacle at Falkirk. Though they'd been away from home until only recently, that action last year was the last time his men had seen combat. He wanted them ready, wanted to move quickly, with a capable, hungry army when the word finally came. Donald MacKinnon cleared his throat and set the letter aside, giving his attention to Callum now.
"I've made arrangements for you to be weighed," he said, without preamble.
Though his blood came immediately to boil, Callum allowed no response to colour his expression. He returned the regard of his uncle, took in the robust features and hard glare, the pocked skin and hulking of his huge shoulders.
"I've said, uncle, I've no interest in taking a bride."
He kept his tone level. Too often, any meeting between Callum and Donal ended in rafter-splintering shouting, both so quick to anger, the elder so intent on ruling with an iron fist, the younger so determined to make his own way, be his own man. Donald's tone was yet conversational when he replied.
"You're to manage all this, all of Kirhi's, when I'm gone. You need a bride, and bairns."
He kept his elbow on the table, but lifted a finger to point at Callum.
"Many bairns. So when your own son abandons you, you have a spare."
Disregarding the bit about Donald's son, Callum admitted this came as no shock. His uncle had been threatening for years. He'd not ever truly thought he might choose his own bride, but understood instead that because the MacKinnons of Nairn, kin to the greater MacKinnons of Skye, were rich in both land and influence, that his bride would be chosen based on what she might bring to the marriage. There would be no love, only politics and power. He exhaled at length and asked,
"Who? And when?"
Donald glanced to his left, squinting down at the topmost paper.
Juliana Elliot. Her stepfather is Angus Fouked, has the Elliot keep near the border, Kinclavin, which makes it easy for him to keep one foot on both sides of this war."
"And on which side does his weight currently sit?" Callum asked, rolling his eyes. He had no respect for any man who practiced such self-serving duplicity.
"Currently with the rebels, he has assured me. But his position, or rather lack of a permanent one, is enticing. If Scotland should fall, he'll turn. And if that should happen, he'll be able to corroborate that we too are loyal to Edward, deserving of consideration for either nobility or more land, or whatever blessings the English king will deliver to his faithful."
"That was done, was it not, uncle, when you signed the Ragman Rolls?" Callum couldn't resist asking. He recalled being enraged at the time that Donal had, with no discussion at all with any other MacKinnon, signed his name to the extortion advocated by Edward I. To his credit, his uncle had resisted at first, hadn't signed the charters of 91 or 92, but he'd caved, or had been coerced, in 96. He'd maintained that it was naught but ink to paper, and not his heart speaking. But Callum had never quite been able to comprehend or forgive. Callum seriously hated when his uncle referred to the patriots, people defending their own land and sovereignty from usurpers, as rebels. But that was another argument, meant for another day, though it had been fought often enough already. He hated more his uncle's deception. Callum knew that nothing, not the threat of death to himself, or even any of those under his protection, would ever allow him to even so much as feign a loyalty to England. But that's what they'd been doing for years, as Callum fought bravely and willingly at the side of true loyalists, like William Wallace, while his uncle walked a fine line between the differing factions of the Scottish landowners and nobles and those same men of English origin.
"When?" "Departing on," Donald said. "Your bride awaits."
He shook a finger again at his nephew.
"Callum, this takes precedence. We need this alliance. The war will wait. Collect the jail straight away and return without delay."
"Aye," Callum ground out.
"Take only your inner circle with you. You're to wed there, at Kinclavin, upon your arrival.
Meet and mate, he thought with some derision. But he gave his nod to the chief of the MacKinnons, as he might one day be that man, and knew well that duty trumped any other prerogative. As you wish, sir. He bowed his head briefly and pivoted, closing the door behind him as he departed, gnashing his teeth with his displeasure. Donald stared at the closed door, his black eyes skinny. The decision he'd made hadn't been an easy one, but it was the right one, he knew. The lad was foolish to believe that Scotland might somehow find herself on the side of victory. For years, Donal had been laying the foundation for the MacKinnons' permanent turn to England's rule and English law. But Callum, he just wouldn't see it, would hear nothing of it. He'd resist until the end, would fight to his own death, would challenge Donal, with force, he had no doubt, would never admit that Scotland would fall, couldn't see past his patriotism to the truth, had no plan for the future when she did fall. Young Cal was reactive, not proactive, always had been. Still, Donald's sigh was heavy for what he must do. But then another knock came, and the Carehays bailiff entered. Cuthbert was made bailiff not for his cleverness or any fine grasp of economics or politics, but for his ability to act shrewdly and sometimes, when needed, without conscience. The ghoul-like man lifted a thin grey brow at Donald, who considered one last time if there were any other way. He nodded, finally, none too pleased about his decision. "Make it happen," he instructed. "Send word to Focht. He's on his way."
"How many should he expect?"
Donald shrugged.
"He goes with his officers, and those young ones who are never far from his side. No more than 10, I would guess. I would expect that Focht can make quick work of them."
The ghoul nodded, looking entirely too pleased that people, kin, were about to die.
"Send that crank, Ollie, down with the gold," Donal advised. "Though it gnaws at me still to have to pay for the disposal. Focht is lucky I didn't reveal his secrets."
Cuthbert departed, giving a gratuitous bow as he backed out of the room. Donal sighed again, chewing his lip. He let only a moment of disquiet plague him for what he had just done, what he had put into motion. He wouldn't dwell on it, though. It needed to be done if the MacKinnons were to survive this war. Claiming a clean sheet of parchment, he put ink to paper again, getting back to work. He had his own wedding to arrange, and an heir to create. Chapter 1.
"Your betrothed comes today," her sister said.
Juliana closed her eyes and digested these words. Dear Lord, her betrothed. She wasn't ready, and wasn't sure she ever would be. Certainly not for a man she'd not ever laid eyes upon. But she pasted on a bright smile and turned to her sister. "He does..." The smile faded, misplaced by its insincerity, as Juliana attended her embroidery. Her hands shook, but there was naught to be done about that. She had only to wait, her meagre trousseau and most treasured possessions packed and awaiting her departure tomorrow. She'd dressed today in her second best kirtle, the light blue one, which her sisters had oft-times told her did remarkable things for her eyes. She'd allowed Effie more time with her hair today, hoping to make a good impression on her bridegroom, lest he think she'd put no endeavour at all toward their first meeting. But it was uncomfortable, the rare arrangement of her long golden hair, and she scratched with some annoyance at all the pins and baubles and ribbons adorning her swept-up curls. She'd thought the little bone beads, made to resemble pearls, she'd been assured,
might have better been suited to her actual wedding, and not the day before. But her sister Margaret had decided that she should wear a crown of summer blooms in her hair for her wedding. The lone comb, tucked inside the coiffure, was made of bone as well, and painted a bright turquoise. Effie had offered it to Juliana with great expectation, which did not dissuade Juliana from declining so precious a gift. She hadn't supposed that Effie, who had laboured at the Elliot Keep for as long as Juliana could remember, might have been able to afford so fine a trinket, and she was well aware that Kinclavin's bone-maker's skill was not so advanced to have achieved so lovely a piece. Effie had shrugged at the time, suggesting guilelessly,
"Stolen, like as no, but no less remarkable for its background. Dinna be wary, lass. The blue is perfect with the kirtle."
Juliana had winced a bit at the very idea. Stolen. As Effie had fixed it to the mass of her hair, Juliana could only hope that it hadn't been thieved from any non-living person.
"Are you excited?"
Juliana was startled out of her reverie and lifted her blinking gaze once again to Margaret.
"Aye,"
she lied, but tempered this with the obvious truth.
"And fairly nervous."
They sat in the hall, pretending some industry with oft-neglected embroidery. In truth, they only waited, using needle and thread to keep themselves from hovering near the door with any of Margaret's excitement or Juliana's apprehension.
"I'd wager he's handsome and brave," said Margaret, who was several years younger than Juliana, the last of the four daughters, and the owner of a most romantic heart.
Never, not once, had Margaret ever been plagued by anything so bothersome as anxiety. She was open and giving, and suffered no qualms about speaking her mind. An easy endeavour, as her thoughts were genuinely pleasant and pure.
"He will fall in love with you upon first sight, and you will be whisked away to his castle in the Highlands. I hope that he is fair, like Gawain, though I'm sorry that I cannot imagine that he could be more beautiful than Gawain,"
Margaret continued, referring to the smithy's son, for whom Margaret had held a devoted fondness since before she could walk, everyone agreed, and to whom she was now wed. Presently, Juliana was more concerned with her bridegroom's manner and his character than she was with his appearance. She'd heard the tales of many a Highlander, of their ruthlessness and their incivility, of their fearlessness and their cruelty. Not for the first time, she wondered why she couldn't have been pledged to a southerner, as her sisters had been, three now suitably wed to genteel men of noble blood and fine manners. Never mind that Gareth, to whom her sister Alice had been joined, was so pale as to inspire one to seek a pulse in his wrist, or that Robert of Finlarig, wed to Hermione last year, seemed to have no care for his new bride, having installed her in his ancient home upon the River Lochay, before departing for and remaining since in Glasgow. Juliana might well meet her intended and wish for such lifelessness, or disregard, if this Callum MacKinnon proved even the most inoffensive rumours of those wretched Highlanders true. Margaret was the only sister near enough, still within the bounds of Kinclavin, to be at Juliana's side today. She'd come with obvious delight this morn, so bonny with the blush of love and sweetness that forever hung about her. It was unusual that she had married ahead of Juliana, certainly because she was 4 years younger, but for two things. Juliana had accompanied her sister, Hermione, after her wedding last fall, her absence allowing her stepfather to forget her existence for a while, and Margaret had long ago vowed that if she were to be denied wedding her dear Gawain, she would take no man but God. Juliana had often wondered if their mother, before her death several years ago, had somehow convinced her second husband that Margaret should be allowed this, for in an unusual turn of events, their stepfather, Angus Fowkt,
had raised no grand furore over Margaret's plans, had indeed allowed her to wed Gowan. She didn't care over much for her stepfather. True, her mother had been happy with him while she'd lived, but Juliana had also blamed him for her mother's demise. Charlotte Elliot had ever been of poor health, so many pregnancies and difficult labours taking its toll on her weak person. Juliana recalled, even at the unadvanced age of 13, being horrified when she'd learned that her mother was expecting another child. Angus wanted a son, not just four daughters who were not his own. And while her mother had been thrilled to give her new husband a bairn, Juliana had only seemed to wait for the inevitable, which did indeed come to fruition, as her mother had perished, along with the bairn, the wished-for son, almost 3 years ago. Never having been the warm and loving type, their stepfather had turned downright surly, and then began to take himself off so often, gone for months at a time, until one day he returned and announced his intent to begin contracting marriages for the four daughters. He'd minced no words, making sure they understood any matches would be for political or monetary gain only, that none of them should seek something so nebulous and useless as affection. Juliana could never be sure how Margaret had managed to escape this edict, but for believing her mother had made him promise, perhaps. In some attempt to engage her mind with something other than worry over her own impending marriage, or any unpleasantness that often surrounded any reflection about her stepfather, Juliana said to Margaret,
"I can hardly fathom that it is already 4 months since your own wedding."
Margaret smiled prettily, her blue eyes brightening.
"Seems as if it were only yesterday. Other times, I feel as if we've been wed forever. But of course, there was no great ballyhoo tied to the event, as Gowan is but a smithy, which bothers me not at all," she was quick to assure.
She sighed and cast her gaze dreamily to the ceiling of the small solar. When she returned her attention to Juliana, she said brightly,
"But you shall have a grand feast in honour of your wedding. Angus will not part with so much coin for anything that even hints at grand. My betrothed is, in Angus's words, a bloody northerner, and I have reached an advanced age where he might only be happy to have me gone, the matter settled."
Margaret laughed, a pretty little sound, and leaned forward to announce,
"You are not old, Juliana. Most girls are wed by the time they are 16 or so, as you were, and I will see my 21st summer this year. But that's because stepfather expects that the match should bring greater benefit to him and to the family. Lucky for me that my sisters have served themselves up on the platter of familial sacrifices, that stepfather is now well pleased with all his alliances in every part of the country, that I was allowed to wed Gowan."
"Fortunate indeed," Juliana agreed. And it was. And she bore no ill will toward Margaret, who was too gentle and too mild to be given to just any man, who might not appreciate how lovely and genuine she was. Gowan was as enamoured with Margaret as she him, which did induce some envy inside Juliana, but only for the lack of it in her life, and not that she wished for Margaret to be stripped of Gowan's affection. Their gazes and attention were stolen by three of the Elliot soldiers racing through the hall, in from the bailey, and disappearing into the corridor that would lead them to the rear yard of Kinclavin, if that be their destination. Frowning, her unattended embroidery ignored now, Juliana stared at the end of the hall where those men had disappeared. A prickle of unease stirred her, that her frown remained as she picked up new sounds, that of growing activity just outside the door. Her breaths came in short, quick rushes, her unease mounting. He was here.
"He must have come," Margaret decided at the same time. Her expression was as colourful and animated as Juliana's was bloodless.
Margaret stood
and grabbed her sister's hand.
You must await your bridegroom upon the battlements. Hurry! Go! I will alert Martha and Effie in the kitchens.
She kissed Juliana's cheek and squeezed both her hands now.
Oh, poor Juliana. Don't be nervous. He will love you, I have no doubt.
For her sister's benefit, Juliana managed a shaky smile and a quick nod, which cheered Margaret and saw her off through the same corridor as those soldiers. Juliana blew a steadying breath through parted lips and walked outside the keep. Bright sunshine smacked her face at the same time her stepfather's voice reached her, come from high upon the wall. 'Twas not unusual at all to hear him shouting and blustering, but it furrowed Juliana's brow yet more. He sounded angry, not excited. Lifting her skirts of blue velvet, Juliana took to the steps adjacent to the main gate and set foot upon the stone battlements, which flanked the entire yard as one massive rectangle. She found her stepfather directly above the gatehouse, one huge paw on the stone embrasure as he leaned out over the wall, watching the great sea of flat land before Kinclavin. His odious man, Levin, whose presence Juliana could never stand for more than a few minutes, noticed her arrival first and thumped Angus Faukt on his arm. Her stepfather turned first to his captain, and at the inclination of that man's head, swiveled his gaze around to find Juliana approaching. Even before her stepfather's ill-favored face screwed up into a heavier frown, Juliana sensed that something was not quite as it should be. Taking her gaze from Angus and Levin, even as she continued to walk toward them, she cast furtive glances around her. Men, Kinclavin's soldiers, scurried here and there. Many were poised at the wall, to the left and right of her stepfather. Sturdy baskets filled with arrows stood at the ready, spaced evenly between all the men. Someone shouted,
"Spence, get down and check that lock. Make sure the brace is tight."
Her lips parted, her eyes finding her stepfather once again.
"What are you doing up here, Jill? Get on down to the... What is happening?"
"There's naught to be fussing about," he said, taking her arm, steering her away from the wall. "Go on now."
"Are we being attacked?"
Oh, dear Lord. She'd heard of such things, of sieges being laid to defenseless keeps, of the savagery visited upon the hapless residents. But no, that couldn't be.
"Nay, child, all is well. Just an exercise,"
Angus assured her.
"But the MacKinnon is expected soon." "No,"
she reminded him, unable to believe she should need to do so. He was the one who had insisted to her that she would marry whomever he'd chosen, and that he was well pleased for having managed a contract with the MacKinnons of Nairn. Her panic increasing for the poor timing of whatever he and his soldiers were about, she asked with some shriek to her voice,
"Stepfather, can this exercise not be dismissed now and rejoined at another time?"
His fingers tightened on her arm. He steered her with greater swiftness toward the steps again.
"It is nothing like that." "Insight!"
a soldier bellowed from further down the wall, bringing both Juliana and her stepfather to a hard stop. At the same time, another man called out,
"MacKinnons are coming!"
Juliana's jaw gaped in earnest now. She wrenched her arm away from Angus and faced him.
"What are you about? Why are you... Sweet St. Andrew, what are you doing?"
Angus Faukt gave up his wretched effort at pretense. A heavy scowl flooded his features.
"He thinks he'll play both sides of the fence, with me in the middle. And I'll not stand for it. I'll be cold in my own grave before I allow some backwoods northerner to destroy what I've worked for a decade to establish."
"But do not forget, sir, that gold exchanged hands as well."
Juliana swiveled sharply, to find Levin lurking with that oily grin of his. His narrow black eyes were on her stepfather when he added with a
sample complete. Ready to continue?